Today, we're talking to Rajiv, CTO at Atlassian, about how he's helping to create joy in the workplace. You're listening to Joel Beasley, Modern CTO.
You know, we get caught up in dumb things. We need to make sure our team is productive and joyful. And how do we do that?
Yeah. So that's a great question because when I came into this role a couple of years ago, one of the big goals we had was developer productivity. And obviously, you know, everyone talks about we want developers to be more productive. And we did a bunch of things and we have done a bunch of programs to make developers more productive. But as we thought about it, we actually leaned into what we call developer joy. And because, you know, productivity and efficiency, these are all goals. They sound very businessy, but as engineers, as developers, we want joy in what we do because that's what we do. We write code, we want joy. And what does developer joy mean? And to us, as we thought about it, it meant, you know, when you're writing code and you're in the flow of writing code, you don't want to get blocked. The thing a developer hates the most is, you don't know what to do next because you want to use a component. You don't understand that API. You have to wait for some engineer to wake up in a different time zone. And you're writing code at 3 a.m. in the morning. And, you know, there's no one to talk to. Like that is, you know, that stops your flow. That stops your creativity. And so we've done a bunch of things to make it so that you can actually find that component. You can find that API and unblock yourself and keep going. And we actually have a product. Atlassian sells a product called Compass. Compass is like a place where you can register every component, every microservice in your company. And so anytime you're stuck, go to Compass, find the component, find the API, find the documentation, and boom, you can get going and you can self-serve yourself and get unblocked. And so we've done a bunch of things like that. That's just one example where we want to make it so that the flow of creation, the flow of writing code isn't hampered. And to us, that's how we have leaned into the joy part of it.
And so you took over for Sri?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. This was about 2 years ago.
How did that transition happen? Was Sri like, hey, Rajiv, I've got something for you?
No, Sri's great. He was the CTO for about 5 years, I think, before me. And he took Atlassian from, you know, on-premise to the cloud and AWS and a whole bunch of transformations. And then, you know, as I came into this role, the founders, you know, Mike and Scott and the leadership, they were looking for someone who could help take Atlassian to world-class engineering. And what we mean by that is Atlassian is a good, solid company, and we have a great aspiration to be like a top tech company. Like we think we could be in the top 10 and we could be a huge provider for knowledge workers. Our mission is to unleash the productivity of every team. And if you want to get to that, we believe that, hey, we need world-class engineering. We need our engineers to be the best in the world, like some of the other, you know, top tech companies. And so that was the goal coming in as I took this role on, was like, okay, now what does that mean? What does world-class engineering mean? And as we break it down, there are three different buckets to it. There is customer trust. How do you build products? How do you build software that earns the trust of your customers? And that is through security, through reliability, through customer support. Like, your products have to work well for your customers. The second pillar of world-class engineering is people, honestly. Like, you need the best engineers in the world, okay? You need 10X engineers. You need amazing senior ICs and engineering leaders and architects, you know, and tech leads who can build great software. So that's the second pillar, and I spent a lot of time on that. And then the third pillar is you want world-class engineering through developer productivity, great architecture, and things like that. And so that's the third component of it. And so we have done work in all three. In the couple of years I've been here to kind of build up towards world-class engineering.
So world-class engineering is customer trust, people, and what's the third thing?
The third thing is basically developer productivity and great architecture, you know, which feeds into developer productivity, right? If you have the right architecture, if you have modern code bases, then developers are more productive.
Do you guys do any of the vetting of people when they're looking to onboard engineers? I know you build a bunch of different tools.
Yeah.
But do you do anything like in the recruiting or validation of skills space?
Yeah. We actually revamped our whole interview process to look for the kinds of skills we would want in engineers, all the way from coding interviews to design interviews. For some senior leaders, we have a really interesting interview where we ask you, what's the hardest technical problem you worked on? And, you know, explain to us like what how that worked and why it was interesting for you and what challenges you faced. I find it very instructive to hear from people about what they have built and how did they tackle the different challenges that came through. So we've done a bunch of things in the interview process. And then we've also done a bunch of things to onboard people when they join Atlassian. So we actually introduced, I was in Sydney about a month back, and we had our very first batch of team camp. We call it team camp. So you join Atlassian, whether it's out of school or an experienced hire, you don't just get into your job. You go to team camp for 4 to 6 weeks. You fix a few bugs. You learn the code base. You learn how to do things in Atlassian, and then you go to your team.
Oh, that's cool. Is that an offsite or is that digital?
It's a 4 to 6 week program, of which we try to get you in on-site for a couple of weeks at least, because, you know, when you're joining the company new, it's good to meet other people in person and build that connection. So there's two weeks that's on-site and then the rest is virtual.
So your job is to take Atlassian to the next level with world-class engineering. And how long have you been at it and how's it going?
I've been at it for 2 years. I've been at Atlassian for 2 years, and it'll be 2 years in a couple of months, so not quite. But
you weren't a promotion from inside Atlassian.
No. I came from outside. Yeah, I was at Meta, Facebook, you know, before that, for 5 years, and then before Facebook, I was at Microsoft for many years. I'm based in Seattle, and you know, I was an intern on Windows 95 back in the day.
The most stable operating system.
Yeah.
That thing's still running. You'll walk by a screen in the middle of you know anywhere, and it'll be Windows 95 install running that display.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. Did you have like hard metrics? I mean, this is a big job. Atlassian is a huge company. You know, to say, all right, we're going to hit this customer trust, people, and developer productivity. What type of KPIs were there or milestones? How do you refer to your goals internally? And then, what were they to do this?
Yeah, let's take security and trust, you know, for example. When I came in, I looked at the scorecards and things like that. And it seemed like, you know, when you look at scorecards, it looks pretty green. I was like, okay, how do we benchmark this? I walked through a few things in terms of things I would expect, you know, in terms of protection at the perimeter or which engineers have access to production machines. You know, like you want to have a system where people, when you access a production machine, you go through some hoops and things and you have, you know, good controls in place. And, you know, we didn't have a good set of things. And I was like, okay, we need to change who we benchmark against. And previously we were benchmarking against other peer companies and we changed it to benchmark against the top tech companies. Having come from some places like that, I knew some of the practices that, you know, companies went and strived towards in terms of scorecards. And so then our scorecard became more red, and then we came up with what we call the top 10 trust commitments, where, you know, we go through the whole SDLC and we have scorecards around, you know, static code analysis and prevention in the SDLC cycle. But then in production, how do we find vulnerabilities? How do we in real time detect problems? How do we make sure that access to production machines is secured? And so we have 10 trust commitments and scorecards against some of those things that I said. And we track that, you know, very, very closely month over month. And that's in security and trust. On reliability, we look at the usual things. We look at SLAs for our enterprise customers. We look at SLOs. You know, if you build a microservice or a platform service that's an internal service, it almost needs to have like 5 nines availability if you want to deliver like 3 nines or 3 nines 5 for an external facing, you know, interaction. So we take our top 10 interactions in our products and we're like, okay, what is the SLA for each one of these things against our different customers? What are the SLOs of the internal services?
Well, and what's an SLO? I'm sorry to interrupt. I've never heard SLO before. What's SLO?
Yeah. It's more like a service level objective in the sense of like you have a microservice that's an internal thing that people use and it has an internal objective in terms of we need this identity service, for example, to be 5 nines, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not directly used by customers, but customer-facing, you know, products use that internal service. And so that internal service needs to be 5 nines if you want the customer-facing product to be 3 nines 5.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And where are you getting... Sorry, I'm a curious guy.
Sometimes it's called an SLI, like a service level indicator. But there is this concept of internal services that have a certain level of availability. And then there's external features that customers use that have a what we call a published level of SLA, right? So when we talk to customers and we say, hey, we give you 3 nines or we give you 4 nines, that's our published commitment to customers. Mm-hmm. That usually tends to be 3 nines or 3 nines, 5 or 4 nines. But in order to deliver that, your internal stuff needs to be like 5 nines or 6 nines sometimes.
Correct, correct. Where do you get your scorecards and how do you manage that?
So we build the scorecards through metrics. You know, we have logging. We use different tools and technologies, you know.
But like if you were looking at the top 10 companies.
Yeah.
And is there a company that looks at the top 10 and builds scorecards and says, hey, this company's doing it this way, this company's doing it that way? Or is that just all internal knowledge and you knowing people? Like, how does that get built?
So part of it is knowing what is great. You know, mm-hmm. I've been at Facebook, I've been at Microsoft, especially at Microsoft, we built Office 365. That was a team that I built. And
That's pretty cool.
The infrastructure to take it to the cloud. Mm-hmm. So as we did cloud, if you go back 20 years and you look at all the companies that did cloud in the beginning, you know, this is all new stuff. So we kind of made up stuff along the way. But over time, we learned, you know, what works, what doesn't work. And what are the kinds of scorecards you need to measure? What are the things you need to measure? How do you have observability? How do you do logging? How do you take all that data and then build the scorecards from it? So there's a lot of, you know, best practice available out there. Some of it I have from my own experience. Some of it was already available internally in Atlassian, and we were able to build on that to build the right scorecards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just curious if there was people writing about, like, for example, Marty Kagan. I follow him for product.
Yeah.
He's my spirit animal for product. I love his book.
Yeah.
And he lists out like frameworks and ways of doing things. And I was just curious if there were people out there that were writing about these scorecards. Because I've heard it a couple times. I know there's like Security Scorecard, which is mm-hmm. a software that does it for security specifically. But I didn't know if there was. But you answered the question. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of this you can get from books and frameworks and thinkers, mm-hmm. but I would say I'm more partial to real world experience, both mine as well as, you know, folks who have done it before for a decade or two. And there's a lot that's available just within the industry in terms of, okay, if this is the thing, what's the best way to go do that? Yeah. Right.
So why Atlassian? Were you connected through friends? Like how did you choose? You could go anywhere. You got Meta and Office 360, but you've done, you're a good name in the space with a lot of experience. Yeah. Why Atlassian?
Yeah, look, I knew someone who happened to know the CEOs at Atlassian, and they were looking for a CTO. And, you know, sometimes you know someone you trust and they're like, hey, I think this is a good opportunity. Do you want to have a conversation? I was like, okay, you know, I'm happy to have a conversation. I talked to Mike Cannon Brooks, who is one of the CEOs, and I really enjoyed the conversation because he struck me, and he is an engineer, and like the majority of the conversation, we were deep into technical code kind of thing. They were like, this is cool. This is just a cool conversation, you know? And then I was like, okay, I see the aspiration of where you want to take this company, and it's an iconic company because it builds Jira, which is something mm-hmm. that's used by every technical team out there. And so as an engineer, for me, it was attractive to be in a company that builds software that's literally used by all engineers, all engineering teams in the world. So the leverage as an engineer, I've always been an engineer, was attractive. And then the aspiration to then make knowledge workers more productive, all kinds of knowledge workers, not just engineers, but also marketing teams, HR teams, you know, non-tech teams. That's our aspiration, is all teams should be able to use Jira to be more productive. If you're building a rocket ship to go to Mars, you should be able to use Jira to track your bug, you know, your sort of project burn down if you want, right? And so that was attractive. And having been at big companies, it was interesting for me to be at a smaller company that's trying to become bigger for two reasons. One is I'm coming in at a leadership position and I can help guide the whole company towards that, having been in other places that were bigger, so I know what that scale looks like. But I also want the journey to be, you know, when a company becomes big, I've seen bad things happen too. I've been through the down years at Microsoft. I've been through some down times at Facebook. So I've seen some things that go wrong when a company becomes bigger. And for me, it was attractive to be able to at least help, hey, avoid these bad movies, okay? Don't do these things, right? Lean into these playbooks. They will help you do better things. And so to bring my experience to a company that's trying to grow bigger was interesting.
Yeah, when I started seeing those videos pop up and go viral of those project manager people who were, oh, I show up at 10, I drink coffee, I lounge outside over at Meta. Yeah, when I saw those, I was like, they're going to have some problems. Luckily, Zuckerberg responded pretty quickly. And yeah, I think he did the best. There's people that completely miss PR opportunities, and I pay attention to it now that I'm in media, but I think he did a great job. He came out and was just like, hey, we're leaning up, we're firming up, like we're not doing that anymore. And that's great. So I think he handled that.
No, I think like at both places I've been, you know, Meta as well as Microsoft, I've seen the great times, I've seen things go down, I've seen things come back up again. And so those are good lessons, and I hope to be able to guide Atlassian through some of those kinds of times.
So a lot of the people that listen are trying to advance in their technology career. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're moving from IC to team lead or team lead to leader of leaders or to VP or CTO, CIO, CXO type deals.
Yep.
Transitionary periods, right? How do you feel about individuals who are individual contributors on a team and they think that they might want to be a leader of a team?
Mm-hmm. That's a topic that's very close to my heart, because when I started out as an engineer at Microsoft, I remained an IC, senior IC, for as long as I could. In fact, I explicitly avoided being a manager. They tried to make me a manager many times, and I was like, no, and I don't want to be a manager. Partly, I got some really good advice from senior leaders who said, early in your career, just try a lot of code, go deep, get technical, understand things really well. And at some point, you can switch to being a manager if you want to. Or you can continue on the IC path. In fact, Microsoft and many other companies have a path where you could become a distinguished engineer or technical fellow or something like that. And you don't ever have to be a manager if you don't want to. In fact, going back about 30 years in tech, we made the mistake of making our best coders managers. And we quickly found out that like that doesn't work. You know, you could have people who are awesome coders, but really bad managers. And over time in tech, I think we have figured out, you know, a better way to go do this. But in a good company, you would have a great path, both as an IC and a manager. And you wouldn't have to decide that in order to grow in my career, I have to manage people, I have to become a manager. That's not a good thing for either for the team being managed or for the person who's trying to advance in their career. So that's what we're doing at Atlassian as well. In the last couple of years, I've hired two distinguished engineers to Atlassian, who are really setting a role model for this is what a senior IC looks like in engineering. And we have really made it very clear that you could grow as an IC or a manager, and both paths can take you as high up in the company as you want. And so to me, that's very important that we have those two paths available so that people can choose. And if you really want to be a manager, you know, we actually make you, the first time you become a manager, we put you through an interview process to really understand what is your true motivation. And one of the things I do when I speak to candidates is I'm like, I try to convince them to not become a manager. Mm-hmm. Like, why do you want to be a manager? You're writing code, you're having fun, like, don't go down this path. But then you get into the true motivation of why they want to be a manager. And usually it comes down to, I really enjoy coaching people. I really enjoy, you know, seeing people advance and helping them out. And, you know, you get the right motivations. And then you're like, okay, this person can actually be an amazing manager. Because we don't want average managers. We want like really amazing managers and leaders or really amazing ICs. We don't want people who are like not doing a good job on either.
Yeah. So that would be a positive thing that you're looking for, is someone who wants to coach people and grow them. And that's what you're looking for in your managers. Yeah.
Yeah. And you got to be like, be willing to do whatever it takes to help the team succeed. And at the same time, you also want people who are like, I still want to be technical. Like I'll pick up the bug that no one wants to fix or that nobody is able to fix. So I continue to stay as hands-on as I can, even while helping guide my team and so on. Like, because we don't want the other thing. We don't want people to become like pure managers where they lose touch. We all joined to write code and to build things. And so you don't want to lose touch with that.
If I'm an individual contributor and I tell you that I want to be a manager, what's something that I would say that would show you that I'm not right to be a manager?
Oh, I mean, you know, usually it's not, may not be said directly, but it's sort of like, I feel like I can advance in my career, you know, faster by being a manager, or I will have more control if I'm a manager. Like those are words that are flags for me, because it's like we expect you to be able to influence things, whether you're a manager or not. And, you know, if you think that just because you're a manager, you can control what people do, then that's that tends to be a flag for me, because engineering is a very tenuous thing where you want to have bottoms up energy and you don't want managers who are trying to like drive things too top down. In fact, I believe in what's called selfless leadership or servant leadership, where it's not that they work for you, you work for them. Like if somebody reports to you, you are working for them, and like you want managers to have that kind of feeling. But if they're wanting to do it because of control, then that's not the right flag.
Are you a parent?
Yes.
How has being, I have three kids. How has being a parent helped you be a manager and a leader of others?
More than anything else.
I mean, me too.
You want the best for your kids. At the same time, you don't want to like micromanage them. You find that balance between telling them what is right and wrong, but also helping them find their own way and not being too prescriptive about things. And because they're your kids and you want the best for them, as parents, we always sometimes are on like doing too much parenting. And then, of course, at different ages, like they'll tell you to back off, and you learn so much at each stage of their life as well. I can say that I'm definitely a better manager leader because of being a parent, for sure.
What's the age ranges of your kids?
My older one is, he's graduated from college a year back, so he's just in a new job. And my younger one, she's in college.
Wow. Dude, you don't look that old. How old are you? This is just you and me hanging out.
Let's put it this way. Told you, I gave you a hint. I was an intern on Windows 95.
Yeah. So. 1995. Yeah, that's right. All right. So I'm 36 and mine are ages 2 to 7.
Yeah.
So I'm, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in the, two, you know where
they,
I'm
they,
at.
They
yeah.
say the terrible twos, two can be a tough age, but you know, it depends on each kid.
It does.
But yeah, I say my, using, you know, computer science analogies, I'm like, in the beginning, it's more like IO problems, and then, you know, the shape of the problems, you know, change. But they are always your kids, and they get more degrees of freedom. So the shape of the problem changes. Like in the beginning, mm-hmm. it's more basic, you know, stuff. And then over time, like eventually one of your kids is going to be driving a car, and that's going to be a big day, you know.
Yeah, I've got a lot of friends who have a lot of kids, and I've got one right now. One of my good friends has 7 kids between the ages of 5 and 16.
Yeah,
and so he's got like one at every different developmental level. Right. I was like, "You're a champion, dude. That's a lot of kids." Yeah. So, all right, yeah. So management for me was an interesting thing, because if you were to talk to me back before I was managing people and I was just an individual contributor, I'd be like, I'm going to be doing this forever. This thing brings me maximum joy. I love solving a problem. I love the explicitness of dealing with these problems over dealing with human problems. You know, humans don't have output logs telling you everything what's going on. And so that's what I would have said until I was put into the position where I was running I built a piece of software that was doing well, and I needed to hire people to help me build that software because I was making money, and it just had to grow from single developer project to multi-developer project. And then I started working on people, and then I found that like people is a fascinating problem. Like, it is really complicated, but it's also, you know, when I see this move and hear people like you talk about moving from IC to first-time leader, it feels like it's a progression, but it's not. It's an entirely different job. It's like saying you're going from the ice cream factory to running marathons. It's like it's completely different set of skills, completely different set of principles, books you need to read, things you need to understand. It's just so totally different. And I found it very challenging. And so to me, it was exciting. And so I figured out how to get good at doing that. Then I realized, and wasn't for control as much as it was for impact. Like, I thought it's cool that I can now direct swarms of engineers towards an outcome that no individual can achieve on their own. And to me, that was cool. And so that, mixed with working with people to achieve some sort of higher level outcome, became the new thing I was addicted to. I was like, that's it.
If I were interviewing you right now for a manager position, I would hire you, because that's exactly the answer I want to hear.
Well, thank you. I'll accept the job. We'll connect me with HR. No.
But you know, that was my journey too. I was an accidental manager. In fact, what happened is like I told you, I tried to avoid being a manager. And then at one performance cycle, my manager came to me and said, you are doing the performance review for these three engineers. I'm like, wait, hold on. I never said I'm a manager. You never told me this. Like, I'm not doing this. And he's like, no, Rajiv, like, we really need you to do it. Like, we basically think of you as a manager for these three people and do it. And so I spent the whole night, like big part of the night at least, going through the code of every one of them with a different lens. Like, so far they were like colleagues writing code, we're writing code together. And now I'm like, okay, I need to go and assess the code. So let me understand what's the design, how is the code laid out? And I came up with some ratings and I forgot about it. But like over time, as I did take on manager responsibilities, I found that there are these different scaling points. You know, when you go from managing three engineers to four engineers, I found my code production came down. When I went from four to seven, I was doing more code reviews. When I went from seven to 22, I was not even familiar with every line of code. And so at every sort of number of engineers, I had to change the playbook of what I did as a manager, you know, going all the way from line level to skip level to, you know, director level. It just changes. So to your example of going from an ice cream factory to a marathon, like even as you go up in leadership levels, it changes completely. Like then there are mm-hmm. these breaking points. And if you don't realize that you've gone past a particular scale point and you're trying to run the old playbook, you'll fail. Like it won't work.
Yeah, to your point, when I see people write in from the show or they ask questions online that I see, and whenever I see somebody asking the question about this is the job title, what are the responsibilities? Like I'm trying to determine what I need to be doing based off of the job title. And I'm like, well, it's going to be different inside of every different business because every different business. So you have to the skill is to understand the needs of the business and how you're able to help the business achieve those outcomes that it needs.
Yes.
And that's going to change constantly.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And you have to be thoughtful about it. You have to think about, you know, what is the job I'm doing for the company? What are the outcomes you want to get? And therefore, what is the playbook I'm going to use, you know, to go do it? One of the principles I have is when I look at things, I think about problems. I'm like, should I manage this through people or should I manage this through process? And by that, what I mean is, you know, in some cases, I have a problem, let's say security, and I might go and hire or I might have a person who is really amazing at security. And I know this person well, I trust the person. So I manage through that person. I keep in touch by talking to that person. They're going off managing different things, but I keep in touch with that person. That's how I manage it. In some other areas, I may not have a person. It might be like two, three different leaders. So then I create a process. I'm like, okay, let's meet once a week or twice a week and let's go through these different things so that I understand it myself. I don't have a single person I can rely on, but I have a process or a framework through which I can manage that problem.
Ooh, that's good. And these principles, these are the things that help you work at these higher levels?
Yeah. You sort of have to evolve a rubric of things, you know, so manage through people or manage through process is one such thing. The other one is a physics example I learned from a leader at Microsoft. And it's like, I call it conduction, convection, radiation, which is, you know, conduction is when you touch a person directly or you interact with a person directly, that's conduction. When you do it through another person, it's convection. When you do it by just sort of like trying to reach a bunch of people through a blog post, that's radiation. So if you're managing 10 people or 100 people or 1,000 people, you can't just say, I have a 1,000-person org. I'm just going to manage it through my direct reports. It's not going to work. You have to find a way to get to know all 1,000 people. You can't literally get to know all 1,000 people because, you know, there's not enough time in the day. But like, you got to find ways to open yourself up so that you meet as many people as you can. You interact with people through blog posts. You do skip levels. You do group meetings. You repeat your message so that everyone understands it. But you have to take the effort as a leader to really actually impact and through conduction, convection, or radiation, you touch everybody in the organization.
By the way, I love that. That's brilliant. How do you find a way to get to know 1,000 people?
In my case, in Atlassian, I have about 5,000-6,000 people overall, you know, in my organization in terms of number of engineers. I travel a lot. I went to Sydney a lot. Maybe I have a lot of people in Sydney. I went to India. I went to, you know, I'm in Seattle. I've come to Bay Area. When I am in these locations, I set up literally a lot of meetings with small groups of people. you know, you can do a, excuse me, you can do a town hall, or you can do like a big event, and you can do Q&A and things like that. And that's a good way. But I find more energy from like meeting groups of 10, 15 engineers in a room, and we take a component and I'm like, okay, deep dives, let's deep dive through the component. Literally, we pull up some code, we go to the whiteboard, we talk through things, and I get a really good sense of, I learn things, and then I give some time for Q&A so that they can ask me questions. And I come away from those meetings getting to know some people, but also getting to know about the area. And I do a lot of those, you know, through the year, or as I travel and I visit different locations. That tells me a lot about, you know, different folks. And just as a leader, you have to be accessible. Like if somebody Slacks you or messages you, being open to that and being able to connect with different people in the organization and being accessible, I think is an important thing. You know, as an engineer growing up, I remember how my leaders used to be and who was accessible and who was not. And I always, you know, felt like if I ever got into a leadership position, I wanted to be connected with engineers and really connected with the reality on the ground, as opposed to like, you know, being high up there in abstract land.
Yeah, you also realize that you have to make a effort because they're less mature in their career often, you know, or
yeah.
There are people at all various sizes of the shapes and steps of their career. But with the newer people, you have to make more of an effort to just constantly remind them, because yeah. they, by default, when you're newer in your career, you look up at the person at the top and it's like scary almost.
Yes.
And you're like,
yes.
Oh, I don't know. They're busy. They won't, yeah. you know, talk with me. And so you have yeah. to be like, hey, the door's open. We're here.
That's right. Yeah.
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 Now, when you're doing the Q&A, so when you're going around and doing the Q&As, obviously you're getting questions about the specific components you're talking about. But what type of career growth or leadership questions do you hear a lot?
Yeah, I think some of it is like, what are your leadership principles, or, you know, what are your values? I hear the values question a lot nowadays. You mm-hmm. know, honestly, when I started as an engineer at Microsoft, there was not so much about values and mission and vision statements and so on. Like my values are very simple: write code, make sure it has no bugs, check it in, and don't break the build. You know, but we didn't have as many like, you know, value posters on the board, on the walls, and things like that. That seems like a more recent thing. Like in the last, you know, 10, 15 years, I see that a lot, and I have people ask me about it. And so I talk a little bit about my values as I have learned them over time. Mm-hmm. And then people ask about, you know, projects that failed, or how would you learn from those kinds of things, you know, things like that. And okay. they're also interested in sort of like, how did you scale your leadership over time? You know, things like some of the things I talked about just now.
What have you noticed about this next generation coming into the workforce? Have you gotten to spend any time with them?
Yeah. Yeah. Two ways. One is my own kids are, you know, in that age and stage, and I learn a lot from them. And then, I try to spend time. I always remember my time as an intern, as a fresh grad. And so I try to meet up with folks, you know, who are in that stage of their career as well. I find, first of all, I'm super impressed. Like when I was their age, I didn't, you know, have that level of like, you know, curiosity. And the thing that strikes me about them is they're very mission oriented. Like they actually care a lot more about, what am I working on? What is the mission for it? Like, how is it going to change the world? How can I make the world a better place? I know, maybe it was me or I don't know what, but like when I started out 30 years back, it was more about like, okay, can I work for a good company? What will I learn? And, you know, I didn't think as much about mission as much, I guess, you know, and maybe it's me, but, you know, maybe it's my generation, but I just feel like the folks coming in now are much more sharper about what they work on.
Mm. Why do you think that is?
Maybe it's to do, you know, with how the world has evolved and, you know, that sort of thing. I don't know. It's
well, we become more connected than ever.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
30
that's,
years.
That's right.
I'm 36. I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
I was the last. So I have a brother who's 3 years older. He's a doctor. And I have a sister yeah. who's 3 years younger. She's a physics teacher. And I was the last generation that was like, you get locked out of the house when you come home from school, you drink from the water hose if you're thirsty, and you ride your bikes in the woods until it's dark, and then you get home.
Then somehow within like a 2-year period, you were a criminal if you let your kids walk to the park by themselves.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, I don't know what happened.
Yeah, but at least
I got in there, and then I got the, you know, cell phones in high school. We got cell phones and that good stuff. So I kind of went from no technology to early adopter to through on that last generation. It's been really interesting to see this next generation come up. But yeah, we get more connected.
Yeah.
And then the life got better. Like we are wealthier and healthier. Well, I don't know about healthier in the States, but I am. Wealthier and healthier than we have ever been as a people. And so your priorities change, right? It's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And
the economy got
so good and there was so much wealth built that people are like, well, now I'm just going to care about the mission. Maybe that's the case.
No, you're right. That's exactly right. In my days, I think we cared more about, okay, you got a good job. Hey, you got a job at Microsoft. Great. And even the sort of culture was one of tough love. Like nobody really gave you a lot of praise for doing good stuff. And if you did bad stuff, like you broke the bill, like you got, on the wall of shame, so to speak. Right. So, whereas like now, I think folks expect more positive reinforcement and
things like that. You leave this conversation, you're like, all right, I just talked to modern CTO guy, we're going to create a wall of shame. All right, so hey, I want to be respectful of your time. I also wanted to touch base really quickly on how, and you, there's going to be things you could talk about and things you can't. So if it's a can't, we can just move on. But I was curious, with this rise of the large language models in the past year, has that made its way into any Atlassian products?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, last year we announced our first wave of AI products. We call it Atlassian Intelligence. We have an annual event in Vegas. We call it Team, last year was Team 23, this year is Team 24. But at Team 23, we announced Atlassian Intelligence. We announced a set of features, and eventually we shipped it in later part of 2023 to all our customers, where you can go into a conference document and it'll auto summarize for you, or you basically get like an AI mate. It's like a teammate who's a virtual member of your team who can answer questions for you in context on projects that you're working on and so on.
Can it hook into Compass?
Yeah, absolutely. We can.
We are
working on it, but we have it with our main products like Confluence and Jira. Mm-hmm. And then we are also working on things where you can do natural. We have a query language called JQL for Jira query language, and you can express natural language statements and it'll do the translation for you to JQL.
So we built
some of those features. And we actually built it on OpenAI. So we have a partnership with OpenAI where we use their LLM to build some of these things. But at the same time, we are experimenting with all the other LLMs out there because it's fascinating. I mean, it's like the LLM wars. And from our perspective in Atlassian, like, we are in the business of building features for our customers, unleashing the data for them. And we stand to benefit from whichever LLM succeeds, like in terms of cost or quality and those kinds of things.
It's like the browser wars all over again.
Exactly. Yeah. Or the cloud, the cloud wars, right? With AWS, Azure, GCP, and so on. I think the big providers will commoditize LLMs to the point where it'll get faster, cheaper, better quality. And companies like Atlassian stand to benefit because we are going to use the best of breed to go and build the best features for our customers.
I just saw the other day that they're pushing to get models greater than 20 gigs being registered with the U.S. government.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a executive order, but I don't know like how that all works. I'm not a constitutional attorney.
Yeah.
I'm not a political person either. Yeah. But I also am like excited for the decentralized. There are some blockchain projects that are attempting to do decentralized AI models so that they're always, because the cat's kind of out of the bag, right? The model's already out there. So,
yeah, but the models are changing too, right? So people are doing custom models. People are doing, all kinds of new models. Every day there's an announcement by some company about some new model. So I think it's interesting. And like as an engineer, as a technologist, like to me, it's super fun and fascinating that we have all this innovation going on.
Oh, me too. I am very excited about it. And did Elon open source his Grok yet or no? I don't know.
I haven't kept up with that.
I haven't played with that at all. Have you played with it at all?
No, I haven't. No.
Hmm. I think that's what it was called. I just saw the headlines. So, you know, there's like only so much headlines you can read. You got to do your work.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you found this episode useful, please share it with a friend or a colleague who you think would get value from it. And if you have topics that you'd like to hear discussed on the podcast, either add me on LinkedIn or send me an email, joel@moderncto.io. Every time I get an email or LinkedIn message, it absolutely makes my day and inspires me to keep going.